That's Rochambeau, isn't that rock, paper, scissors?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
I had my rock, paper, scissors shirt on.
Yeah.
All right, ready?
Yeah.
Oh, damn it. All right, well.
Victor.
I'll take out the trash.
You know that there are 80% chance to beat a man in rock, paper, scissors is?
Punch him?
No, just do paper. Because guys always choose rock. 80% of men choose rock. So if you want to beat a man in rock, paper, scissors, all do is choose paper.
Boys.
So, welcome to the podcast.
No, you have to do hello. And welcome to another episode of the CG Garage.
What episode number is this, Gina?
27.
Do you know who we're featuring on the episode?
Dan Rorty.
Yeah, and where does Dan Rorty work?
I have no idea. I'm sorry, Dan. But I do look at his rendering of Grandma every single day. She stares at me.
That's right. Yeah. Do you know, you know Grandma is, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, she's right outside.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Dan Rorty works at Microsoft, actually. He's been working in the game industry for a while.
Well, then I got a bone to pick with.
The game industry. Do you have it?
Sorry, I just heard Microsoft and I shut down.
You don't even own a Mac. Yeah.
You know.
Well, you own an Apple watch thing. What is that?
No, it's not a phone. Watch. It's a phone.
Gina just got a new gold iPhone.
It's not gold.
It's a
the
gold.
The Aussies next to me distracted me. So whatever the woman was selling me, I said, okay. And then I walked out. And
so you walked out with a gold phone because there are some guys with an Australian accent behind you.
Wow.
No, they were to the side of me.
Pretty sad.
I know.
All right. Well, Dan was a really great guest. We had an amazing talk. He is also a member of the Digital Human League. And we talked about digital humans and the WikiHuman project. And it was really cool. So hopefully you guys enjoy it. I don't know how this intro is going to go. I think
recording?
Yeah, it's recorded.
Welcome to another CG Garage where the chaos group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're going to fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
You listen to a few of these, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So yeah. They're pretty chill.
Yeah,
you know.
Which is awesome. Casual, cool, and general as possible would be awesome.
Yeah. So those are always fun.
Yeah.
I like that. So
save the really techie ones with Paul for Paul.
Did you listen to the Paul one?
I did. It was excellent, actually.
It was really good. Yeah. I loved it because, you know, it went into some very techie stuff. But also we talked about, you know, some philosophical stuff at the end about what it means to sort of work on humans and what he wants to do with it. So I like that. I like that aspect of it.
Yeah.
So, and some of them, like the Graham Fife one was very, very techie and hilarious at the same time. So
it's awesome. I think more people are starting to listen to these too. They're getting good buzz and stuff as well. So
yeah.
Which is excellent.
Yeah. Our week where we did it with Paul, because it came out at the same time that we were releasing the WikiHuman data, it brought a lot of traffic to the site. But we ended up, I think we had, that was our biggest week. We had 10,000 downloads that
Holy
week.
Holy cow. Wow, no kidding.
Yeah. So it was excellent. That's really good. And so we normally get about, I don't know, 6,000 or 7,000 a week, which is pretty good. But that one was a huge week for us. And Paul's was great, but it also hit a bunch of the other people in the group because it all kind of works together.
I thought that was really cool, actually, yeah.
And I love doing it because it's really kind of, it's not that hard or complicated to do. I get to sit down and talk to people and I get to share it. And I think it's amazing how many people drive to work and just listen to podcasts or listen to podcasts at work, you know?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I do them all the time. Yeah. I found it really interesting listening to Paul and kind of from his standpoint with ICT and everything and stuff too. So that was excellent. It was really cool.
Yeah, his history is pretty interesting.
Yeah.
So let's talk about your history to start with. Yeah. So based on your website, you started working at MTV, is that right?
Yeah, so my first gig, I was actually still in college at the time, and MTV had come into the school. They got a hold of my demo reel that I was working on.
Right.
And they contact me and they're like, "Hey, would you be interested in doing a small animated short for us?" And I said, "Well, yeah, that sounds awesome." Here I was still in school and everything, so I basically had to put together a small animated reel for their TV show at the time, which was MTV Select in Canada. And the premises was the host of the TV show was actually going to have like a talk show interview with my 3D character at the time, Guz.
Uh-huh.
So that for me was my first basic kind of breaking into the industry where I had to render everything out. I actually even did the voice acting for my character, and I had to get a bunch of students to kind of help me animate it and stuff. So that was really cool.
And so what's interesting is that, so basically your first job was a character, right? So you worked in character.
So when I was actually in school, I knew I wanted to get into doing the arts. I knew I was excited about making characters, but I also actually really loved animating. And I actually still do a little bit of animation on the side. So with that, it was modeling, finishing up the model with him, and also doing a lot of actual animation and lip syncing and all that kind of stuff. So it was pretty cool.
Okay. Well, that's really interesting. I think that that what happens in those first jobs are always kind of help model where you end up going in the long run. But you sort of, was that the only sort of thing you did in broadcast, or did you sort of, what led you to get into the game industry?
Well, growing up in Vancouver, like I'm born and raised in Vancouver.
Right.
At that time, there wasn't a lot of film in Vancouver. And this is, you know, I date myself. It was about 12 years ago, I guess.
Sure.
So back in the day, Vancouver was a huge hub for video games. We had Radical. We had obviously had EA. We had Rockstar. We had Propaganda. Yeah, there was a ton of game studios. So I wasn't geared towards going towards games and or film. It was basically if I can get paid to work on, you know, cool character shit, basically I'll do whatever. And at that time, there was just a lot of great game studios, basically in the Vancouver area. So that's kind of basically how I got into it.
And then, sort of, you stayed in the game industry for the most part at that point, right?
So I've been doing games now for like 12 plus or something like that. For the most part, I've been working on games, and in my spare time, you know. Small contract stuff here and there,
right.
Where I focus more on the film type aspect of it.
Okay. Yeah. And what is your main role in the game industry? What do you usually do?
So I'm a lead character artist at Microsoft on the new Gears project that we just announced. So I'm in charge of basically the characters and the character team, from modeling, texturing, blend shapes, you know, hair, all that kind of stuff. So
gotcha.
It's focused on all aspects of basically modeling and building a character.
And these are game assets, right?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
So
we use some stuff. Some of the stuff we do pre-rendered stuff for some of the marketing.
Sure.
Marketing stuff, but yeah, for everything we do for most part is real time.
So that's kind of a challenge in itself, isn't it? To work on characters that look as real as possible.
Yeah, it's a huge challenge. I almost find it easier sometimes going home and making, you know, if I'm making like a photoreal character on the side, it's for one, it's static. I don't really have any limitations, but with games, you do have a ton of you're handicapped by a lot of different things. It's getting way better now where our budgets are better, the skin shaders are better, like our hair development is better, but
and you have more RAM available to you. Game platforms are getting more robust.
Yeah, especially like more. So yeah, I mean with all the new systems that are coming out right now, there's it's interesting looking at it from the past, you know, 12 years working on games, how much better the systems are getting now where it's close to film.
Right.
But it is, I mean, it's still real.
But what's amazing to me is that some of these systems, I mean, they stick around. Like, right, so an Xbox 360 was around for like 10 years or something like that, right?
Yeah.
So you had to, when you were building games, you had to build something for a 10-year-old piece of hardware.
Yeah.
That's really hard.
Yeah.
Because and then suddenly when, you know, the new Xbox One comes out or whatever it is, you know, the Sony One or whatever it is, I mean, it's like, okay, now it's a lot better, but you like that's going to be that's going to be it for 10 years.
It's hilarious because we're working in the games, you get so excited when a new system comes out because being an artist,
right?
Oh, what does that mean? Like how many more polys do I get? How many more maps do we get to do?
Exactly.
Like, how's the skin shader going to look? So it is a challenge because you're stuck working on, you have like a limited budget basically for 10 years, like you said.
Right. And it's funny because you use the term budget, but that's actually what it is. It's like a RAM budget. Yeah. It's a RAM budget, right?
Yeah. Like we're pretty strict on, you know, if you're making a character, you're only allowed to use these amount of maps. Your poly count has to be like this. If you're going to use shaders, how are you optimizing them? How are they being used? How are you doing here?
Yeah.
But that's also the part I find really exciting. Like
I
love the idea of getting something to be technically optimized and running real time.
Yes.
And and make it as efficient as possible.
I think that is actually the key to me is sometimes artistically speaking, restrictions can make more creative decisions.
It's true. And like selfishly, I go home and if I'm doing like a 3D render or portrait.
And you can do whatever the hell you want.
Yeah, who cares, right? Like it's just, it's 6.5 million polys, whatever. Oh, maybe I won't even use a displacement map. That for me is a good outlet. I can just go home and start working on you do that kind of stuff. But but now, especially with like the newer systems that are out now, it's getting a lot closer. Like I'm finding the gap between if you know, the personal work to the business everyday stuff with games, it's getting so close, it's awesome. Yeah.
So let's talk about some of the games and companies you worked on, just to give people in perspective.
So we just announced the Gears project, which is awesome, Gears 4.
Yep.
And previous to that, I was lead character for Tomb Raider. This was really cool for me. I felt pretty fortunate that we teamed up. Team up with Xbox, where we just announced Rise of the Tomb Raider and Gears of War 4, and I was fortunate enough to work on both of them. So worked on Tomb Raider beforehand, and then previous to that, I was at Crystal Dynamics. Previous to that, I was at LucasArts, Lucasfilm, working on Star Wars 1313.
Nice.
Yeah, and that was actually really cool. That was actually the first kind of next-gen thing we were able to put out, which was really cool.
Nice.
And then previously, I worked at 2K for a bit. I worked on like some of the sports titles over there, and that's been my stint basically in the United States. And previous to that, I worked up at a studio called Radical,
mm-hmm.
which eventually got bought out by Activision, and worked on Scarface, Crash Bandicoot, Prototype, and then previous to that, I worked there for about 4 years. Wow, I'm dating myself now. And then previous to that, I worked at kind of a startup called Boogeyman Studios. We worked on Spy Hunter 3. It was kind of like an outsourcing company. Back in the day, you never even thought of anything as being like an outsource company.
Sure.
Outsource was huge back then. But and then previous to that was the MTV thing. So
how long is it? I mean, how long are you working on a project, generally speaking? Like if you're going to be a character, like on this project, how long do you think you'll be on it?
So we've been on it for a little while now. I think it's scheduled to be released holiday 2016. So I've been on this project for roughly, I guess, about 10 months or so. And everything's actually, everything's actually going really, really smooth. Everything's
nice.
Been really, really good. It really depends on the project. When I was on 1313, we spent, 2.5-3 years on
right.
it. Unfortunately, and everything that happened so people don't know, when I was at LucasArts, I was on 1313, and shortly afterwards, we got bought by Disney, and it basically kind of closed LucasArts, which is a real bummer. But it can range. Like some games, if you work on a sports game, can go for like a year. And then if you work on like a huge AAA game, it can go, 2 to 5 years, basically.
Right.
Like I know GTA, they spent like 5+ years on their stuff.
Yeah, so it is almost longer than working on a feature animation. Feature animation was like, 2-3 years. Because most films, like people work on a VFX on a film now, it's probably about 9 months.
Yeah.
But games is like 3 to 5 years.
It's
on
a huge investment.
Yeah,
it's a huge investment. And especially like when you're working on a franchise like Tomb Raider, like mm-hmm. it is a franchise. So there's a certain you know that you're going to be working on a certain amount of games for that franchise for a certain amount of time.
And sure.
It's pretty well organized where you know, like, for these many years I'm working on this and these many years I'm working on that. But, yeah, it's a slow burn for sure.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So you mentioned that you do a lot of stuff sort of on your own time, right? So you come home and you do things on your own. So what is exactly that you do?
Well, I try to do a little bit of everything, but I focus. I've been, I guess, labeled as like a portrait dude or whatever. Like I make a lot of portraits, which right. I like to do. And that's actually which, you know, talking about the WikiHuman project and stuff, like I'm really interested in overcoming the uncanny valley and trying to get something to look as photoreal as possible. So,
right.
Yeah, when I'm at home, whether it's at night or in the morning, I'm cranking on usually photoreal type characters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so what led that? I mean, why did you want to, is it basically like your painting and what is it, the idea that of is doing this type of portraitry?
Oh, that's a good question. When I was younger, I was a Jurassic Park. Actually, we were talking about Jurassic Park earlier. Yeah. Jurassic Park was one of the, Jurassic Park and Star Wars were films that I basically knew, like, that's it. Like that's what I want to get into. I want to work on that kind of stuff. When I was 13, for my 13th birthday, I begged my parents to buy me a 3D program, which is usually not the norm for a 13-year-old kid. But they did. We went to a local store up in Canada, and they bought me, I don't know if you ever heard of True Space.
Remember? Oh,
True
yeah.
Space. So they bought maybe, it was like True Space 3 or 4, uh-huh. what it was.
And that's not cheap.
No, it was expensive.
No, it's not like a $40 toy. That
no,
you want. No,
it was a few hundred bucks at least.
Yeah, that's like that, you know, buy you an iPod or, yeah. you know, it's like you're buying, this is software?
Yeah.
I can imagine that was my
computer. Yeah. And I mean, our computers back then, they sucked. You really couldn't do shit with them.
Right.
But, I begged my parents and I think they knew I'd always be drawing and working on that kind of stuff. And I was just... I knew, you know, right off the bat that's what I wanted to do. And right. I basically, my grandma and my mom, we used to draw characters all the time. My uh-huh. grandma's actually, both of my grandma and my mom are actually really good artists. So I was hooked on making characters. So as soon as I got that True Space program, mm-hmm. any chance I would get to make anything, I would do it. And it just built into kind of like an obsession where, you know, I was like, how real can you make a character look in 3D? And I remember Final Fantasy coming out and stuff, which I loved. I thought it was awesome and stuff. I remember getting the seats and going there and watching it. It was just an obsession. It's been kind of an obsession for me ever since, where I've just always wanted to make a realist. Like I've just always wanted to make realistic characters in 3D and stuff, and I still do it.
Yeah. I mean, your characters are pretty well known, and obviously they've been on the cover of lots of magazines and stuff like that. I remember the Lon introduced me to you when I first started the company, and we were talking about digital. Yeah. I was like, oh, you should talk to Dan Rorty, look at this stuff he's done. And one of the things that, for those who are listening, in our office we put up a lot of renderings all over the place. They're all hanging all over the place, which is nice.
Really cool.
And we were testing out different sizes and stuff like that. And we had a small size, like, you know, like 8x10 frame. And we put the picture of your grandma. Happy birthday, Nana. We put it in that thing. And it's just sort of sitting there like it's at someone's house, you know, like you have a framed picture of someone's grandmother and they're like, why do you have a picture of someone's grandmother in your office? And it's like, that's not a picture, that's a rendering. And then that's an immediate conversation starter. Yeah. It's like, whoa, that's a rendering? Because that's not a subject matter that you normally see in CG, right?
True.
It's a lot of, if when people start doing character work, and this is what I've actually really appreciated about some of the stuff that you've done, it's like, if you go to a lot of these sites, you know, like the 3D Tools and stuff, and they're great sites, and there's amazing artists out there, but subjects usually involve people in bikinis or
cool chicks with guns.
Cool chicks with guns and swords and stuff like that. And or monsters or aliens and stuff like that. Yep. And that's fine. That's
all cool.
That's all good. But I like the fact that you're like, I'm gonna do a rendering of my grandmother at her birthday and make it look like a home photograph. It looks like someone took a camera and took a picture and it's a really pretty, beautiful smile. It's very honest looking, right?
Yeah.
And so it's not glamorous in a sense.
No.
it's very genuine, and is really kind of cool about it. And I think that's what puts people off guard about it being CG.
They don't really, I've had that a couple times. People don't really, they don't get it at first. Just like, yeah, why do you have a picture? Actually, it was kind of neat because I walked, when I opened the door, it was kind of the first thing I saw.
Right. Yeah, but I think that's what puts it in context to me, right? So you put it there, it's like, that's how you would normally see an image like that. And so I put it there, and then it becomes this conversation starter. It's like, well, I understand that you normally have a picture of like your grandmother, you know, on your mantle or something like that. But now suddenly it's in an office, and it's like, it's a rendering.
Thrown off a little bit,
yeah. And so I think it gets people up, which I love. I love the idea of finding the right way to express yourself in terms of your image. And you did obviously a bunch of other stuff as well.
My wife as well. Yeah.
You did your wife.
So I echo basically what you say. Like I think it's really cool seeing like the cool monsters and the, you know, hot chicks with guns and all that kind of stuff. And they actually do really well, like on all the 3D sites and stuff. For me though, I wanted, I've always been into making pieces that are kind of, you know, mean something to me, something that'll inspire me to actually do it and work on it. And I promised my wife when we've been together for 14 years now.
Wow, there you go.
Hey, Blue. we've been together for 14 years, and I promised her when I was actually in school that, you know, one day when both the software gets good enough and my skills get good enough, like I'll do justice and I'll try to make a version of you in 3D.
Right.
And I did, and I got pretty lucky that it kind of hit a niche, and it resonated with people, I think, because it was something different, I guess. Like it was, I was basically making something that was meaningful to me, and you know, obviously, I wanted people to appreciate it, but I did it because it was a promise I had made, and it inspired me to kind of do it. The same thing with my Nana. So they were personal projects for me, basically.
Yeah, which is, I think it's great. I think it's good, and that's the inspiration you want, and I think that it sort of shows through. And I know you've also been, you're still working on your self-portrait too, which has been pretty funny.
Yeah.
But it's come pretty far along.
Yeah, I've taken a little bit of a break with that.
I know you're working on a pirate guy.
Yeah, I'm working on a pirate guy. I don't know. I try to finish my projects. I don't like to leave things stagnant for too long.
Sure.
I do want to finish it. I also find it weird like working on my own face and stuff like that. So
well, I think it's really cool is because, you know, obviously I follow you on Twitter and we'll put your Twitter on the thing, but I think it's amazing that you can just post things and I'm just following along what Dan's doing. It's like, so it's like, oh, here's how far you are. You're not afraid to share. That's another really great thing. Not only are you not afraid to share, you eagerly give tutorials to things. So show people everything about the process of what it goes. Yeah. So that's a really nice aspect of it as well. And I think it's really cool that you're able to do that. I want to bring up something that you and I talked about at lunch. We just got back from lunch, obviously, but we were talking about things. And the idea of finding the time to do that, right? Because I know a lot of people say, you know, they're going to work on personal projects at home or whatever, and they're exhausted, and they never actually get around to doing it, right? And they have all these ideas of what they want to do, and they never can actually do it. And there are ways of doing it. One is just do it. Right?
Just do it. Suck up and do it.
Yeah. Suck up and do it. But you've also brought up a really good point, which I remembered, and it brought up my own story, is the time of day that you do something
has
a huge effect on it. So tell me what you were telling me.
So I like probably most 3D artists, I would work on stuff, you know, whether it's on Microsoft or Crystal, wherever I was working, at the end of the day, go home, hang out with the wife and stuff. And then at nighttime, that's when I would crank on stuff until like, you know, 3 or 4 in the morning, wake up exhausted and do the whole thing over again. I got shit done. Like that's how I used to do it. But I always felt tired and beaten down and everything. So
it's hard to motivate yourself to do anything.
It is
sometimes
tough. Like I'm always motivated to work on stuff, but it sometimes you just feel exhausted and you feel like, well, this is the time I have, you know, I can't do it, you know, 12 in the afternoon. So like this is the only time I can do it. And I basically got to a point where I was just like, I was just so tired, you know, after a certain age, like you can't keep up with it. I can't do it anymore. So my wife gets up really early and she goes to the gym at like 4 in the morning and stuff. And she's like, you know, you might want to start thinking about getting up, you know, really early and working on your own stuff. And I, at first I was just like, that, ludicrous. Like, if I wake up at 4 a.m. and work on stuff, like, Kurt, you know, I'll just do it at night.
Right, right.
But I started doing it. I tried it. So I get up now at 4:30, and that's when I work on my own stuff. And
right.
I'll tell you, dude, I'm so much more I get up, have like a bulletproof coffee, and I'm basically, I crank on stuff until I have to go to work, go to the gym, or do whatever. And I'm refreshed. My mind is working. I find like I'm not on Facebook and Twitter and all this other stuff. Like I'm just so focused and so ready to go after like a good night's sleep.
Yeah.
And the work, and we talked about this, the work you get done when you're refreshed, you know, and not tired at the end of the day is just paramount. Like it's so much, you get so much more shit done.
Yeah. I mean, there's always those things, you know, so you've worked at a, you know, big facility or whatever, you have these guys that work really late at night. And then they end up coming to work late because they were working late. So they come to work at like 10 o'clock or whatever. Yeah. And then they try to like, they just eke through the day because they're still exhausted. And then they try to keep working and they're like, they get more productive. They try to get more productive towards the end of the day when everyone's left, but they're already really tired.
Yeah.
Right. And so they don't actually get much done at that point. And so they end up working even later because they're not getting enough done. Right.
Yeah.
And so it just becomes this vicious cycle. So it's like, okay, so, you know, everyone's gone after like, you know, 7 o'clock, let's say. And so you're like, okay, I'll work till 10, but you don't actually get as much done. So you end up working till 2.
100%.
And then you end up coming to work like later. And then it's just like, it's just this vicious cycle, like you said. So when I was in architecture school, I was telling you this story. For my thesis, I noticed that like, you know, everyone was doing classes, whatever, during the day. And then we all had a studio. We all worked together. And people would do their actual work on their thesis, you know, splattered throughout the day, but most of the time spent 100% in the studio in that evening time. Yeah. So after evening classes or whatever, they go out and they come back, they all go in the studio and then they're like, oh, okay, well, you guys want to go get some dinner? And then they all like get up and then they go get some dinner and then they come back and it's like, you guys want to get some coffee? And then like get up and get some coffee. And they're all exhausted and their day are till 2 o'clock in the morning working in the studio. But, and they're just really, really tired. And so that's the time when you're supposed to be doing the most amount of work on your project and you end up doing the least productive. Yep. And so what I decided to do, and it was kind of a radical idea at the time, is I decided I was going to go to bed at 6 o'clock in the afternoon and wake up at midnight. So that gave me 6 hours of sleep, which was enough for me at the time. And I'd be at studio by like 12:30 or 1. And by then, people were starting to leave exhausted, and I was like, I was good to go, man. I just got up, And I was just cranking on my work, and I, like, you know, we didn't have Facebook or anything back then. That was a long time ago. That really dissed me. I think I had an email address, and that was about it. There was no .com yet.
Yeah, sure.
Let's just put it that way. There was EDU, but no .com. Yeah. And so, but I was just cranking out stuff, and I was doing all these renderings, actually.
Yeah.
And it was so much better just to do it when you wake up. And it's really kind of that thing that keep in mind that, you know, people who complain about, I just want to do my stuff, I just don't have time when I get home or I'm exhausted. Fine. When you get home after work, you want to chill out, then chill out. Don't try to do that. But what I like about what you're talking about is that's your chill out time. What you're doing when you're doing your portraits and stuff.
That is.
That's your chill. So when people are like, that's your equivalent of, I'm going to play a video game.
Yeah.
I'm going to watch a movie. I'm going to do some renderings.
Yeah.
And people sometimes, I think, see that as like how I couldn't go home and do renderings. I do that for my job all day long. But you're doing a different type of rendering. So it's completely different than what you're probably doing at work.
Yeah, that's a great story, by the way, about the sleeping thing. So I think that actually resonates with a lot of people.
Right.
For me, I love watching movies. I love spending time with my wife.
Sure.
Love playing video games. But if I'm able to work on my own personal project and work on cool stuff or do some V-Ray renders or whatever, that for me, that's a hobby. Like that's my
mind
time. Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
So that for me is a chill out time, and I want to feel, you know, motivated and refreshed and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
So nighttime now is basically recovering from the day, and morning times is like, that's my time now. Like I get up and I'm so ready to go.
Yeah. That's your jogging or whatever it is going to be. Right.
Yeah.
So, anyway, I love the idea, and I want to make sure, like, hey, people should hear that. That's not a bad way to work if you want to do your own projects. Is just find a way to work on it in the morning.
Yeah, I tell you, yeah, I would try it out. I'd tell people to try it out. So my our character team at Microsoft, we have Daniel, Michelle, and Abair, which are amazing artists. And I know that I think Daniel now, he actually gets up in the morning. He starts doing that kind of stuff too.
Yeah.
He even comes into work like early. And so is Michelle. Yeah. They actually come in really early and start working on
stuff. Yeah, Daniel Buck comes to work at 6 o'clock in the morning.
It's crazy, right?
Right.
And for some people, it's like 6 o'clock. Oh, what, are you kidding me?
Yeah, he says it's great.
You get so much more work done.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, so I would say, and I know I talked about this with our mutual friend Alan McKay. Like, we talked about it on Monday and stuff. We had a podcast with over there as well,
yep.
And we talked about that, like just getting up in the morning, start working on stuff. And I think even his girlfriend does the same thing.
Really?
Yeah. Maybe it'll catch on. I don't know.
Yeah. Before you know it, all these CG artists showing up at work at 6 o'clock in the morning. Like, yeah, I don't think that's gonna happen.
No, probably not. Probably not.
That's the good thing. It's like those who are willing to do it, they're gonna be the ones.
Yeah.
That,
yeah, you know. Never know. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was really, really kind of cool. The other cool thing that was about doing that during my thesis is that there was no render farm really that we had back then. So my render farm was me just sort of going to every computer and like designating 100 frames here, 100 frames there, 100 frames there.
Do I remember those days?
And so I would just basically take over the entire lab, and then like I'd have these little post-it notes on his Chris Nichols rendering or whatever. And so it's like, oh, Chris is taking over the lab again. But yeah, I remember like doing those type of things. So it was cool. All right, there's a couple other things I want to talk about before. I got to know you based on Lon telling me about you and seeing your work, and I was like, I need to talk to Dan about this stuff, because when we first started, this is before we even started the Digital Human League or anything like this. The idea is that, you know, we wanted to do something with character work because Vlado had just done a bunch of work in V-Ray to get some really cool stuff going with skin and hair and stuff. And he says, this version of V-Ray 3, there's a lot of stuff in there that's built for character.
Oh, yeah.
And so he wanted to say, hey, you know, if we're going to do some special projects or whatever, can we do something with humans? And that's what started the whole thing with Paul. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, well, we'll do a rendering with Paul of Paul.
Yeah.
But we needed someone to work on the rendering part of it. And so that's when I contacted you, and you're like, yeah, that sounds great.
Yeah, that was so fun. Yeah, that was awesome.
And what was interesting is like, we had like 2 weeks to do that.
It was a pretty quick turnaround.
Right.
It was, and it was super, like, man, it was a lot of fun to work on.
Right.
I was super excited. But yeah, I mean, like, you guys were busy. I was super busy. I like did lines and stuff too, we had like a quick turnaround, and I think like, we got done pretty quick.
We wanted to make it like, you know, the thing that was interesting about it is it sort of started the idea of making the data look as scientific as possible, but still make it rendered nicely, right? So the bridge between the science and the art was kind of formed in my head about what this is going to happen. And so once that project started, I'm like, all right, I want to get more people involved. And that's what sort of formed the idea of the Digital Human League, and which is now really, really gotten big.
Yeah. Props to you for doing it too.
Yeah.
Like it's amazing to see like what you're starting to lead now with everybody that's involved and stuff. It's exciting.
Yeah. And it's become this thing because, you know, one of the things that was interesting to me, especially, you know, when I started working with you and you were working on the Paul thing and we were putting it together and you were handing me your scene file, I was like, whoa, I would not have put the skin shader together. It wasn't necessarily a criticism. It was like, I just wouldn't have done it that way, you know? And so I sort of was like, everyone's doing it a little bit different. Cause Matt showed me something he'd done at one point, Matt Arney, and it was different as well. Very different. So I was like, there's gotta be a way that we can figure this out. So, trying to figure out the art and science and balance that out became sort of, a big deal. And, we're at FMX and we showed the first version of Digital Emily 2, mm-hmm. And we gave that data out. And I think some people may not realize that that's not like, here we have the answer. It's all done. Like we'll never have the answer of it. And it's constantly going to be evolving. And in fact, right now we're working on very, very soon, we'll have Digital Emily 2.1.
Yeah, so exciting.
And she's looking pretty good. Yeah. And the idea that I want to have now is to work on the artists that are in a part of the Digital Human League all do their own sort of version of the rendering so that we can see where artists lie. Like,
yeah, that's true.
Because the thing is, like, I can take an actress and have 15 different photographers take different pictures of an actress, and they're all going to look different.
Yeah.
And there's no reason why the rendering can't be the same thing, right?
That's true. It's this, I mean, a lot of, especially industry professionals, this is like really exciting, especially as a character artist, because like you said, if it's myself or Matt or Luke or anyone who's going and doing their own rendering stuff, you know, to be honest, like for me, I'm using my eye more than anything else. Like I think about it, but I don't, science doesn't come into a lot of the play when I'm doing render stuff. Like I like being an artist. I like going in there, mucking around, changing the shaders and stuff and using my eye basically to see what looks good. But the idea of getting something that's like scientifically correct, that we can have data to share like to everybody in the industry and stuff is hugely beneficial. Like it only makes things look better.
Well, it reduces the variables, right?
Yeah.
Because you're while you're doing everything by eye, which is great, you got a lot of knobs to tweak before 100%. You get something there.
Yeah.
And if you have less knobs to tweak, then you can focus on the other part of it, you know?
Yeah, and we were talking, like you said, like you were talking about a student who is just like so excited about actually having this data. Like,
right.
Well, you like, I get this, like I get to use this and stuff. Yeah. Like how awesome is it? Because you're not going to, whether it's Emily or Paul or like any other head, you're using that data as a sign, using the scientific data to make your own project, to do your own stuff.
It's reference.
Yeah, 100%.
And that's the thing. It's like, you know, when you're doing a rendering of, let's say rendering of your wife, right?
Yeah.
Did you start with a photograph? Did you look at photographs?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Right. So that's your reference, right? Is your photograph. You have to make it look like that photograph. But now what you're doing is on top of giving a reference of Emily, you're also saying, by the way, here's what a diffuse map needs to look like. Make your own diffuse, but that's the values. If you use this shader, that's the values of the diffuse that you should be using. That's the values of the spec that you should be using, you know?
Yeah.
And we have reasons behind all these decisions, right? Trust me. There's discussions going on exactly why it is 100% that value. It's not like, I just tweaked it till it looked good. Like, that's not what's going
on. Which is a classic artist. Like, that's
fine. And that makes sense for the artist to do that.
Yeah.
But that's not the way ICT operates. Yeah. If they're going to make a decision about something, there's a reason behind that decision, right?
And that's what I find exciting. I think that's, especially the people that are involved, you know, right now, especially with the Digital Human League, I look at some of the emails and the talk back and forth and,
right.
and what's coming with the Digital Emily and everything. And I'm so excited. Like, and almost selfishly too, because I was like, wow, I can't wait to start using this, start looking at the data. And what am I going to be able to do with this? And I think it's great, you know, overall.
Yeah. I think having so what's interesting to me about, especially with all the different artists that we have, one of the things that I try to make sure is, one, that the artists that are involved are very open to discussion and have good voices and stuff like that. But also that every one of those artists, and you know this for a fact, that like they're very different styles.
Yes. Yeah.
And they're all very realistic styles, mm-hmm. but very different styles. And so that difference in style to me is an important part of the attribute of what makes something look human or what it is. Because the interpretation of what that is always going to be different.
Yeah. Like, After, and as you mentioned, like this is it's an ongoing thing. Nothing is final right now. It's building and building and building. I'm excited to see, you know, what one of the artists is going to take and how they're going to render and how that's going to look. Because everybody has different styles.
Yeah. And they're going to drive each other. So like, oh, share with this. Oh, like, yeah, you know, someone's going to do a real shallow depth of field close up or someone's going to do like, you know, really distant or some interesting lighting or studio lighting or outdoor lighting or whatever. So it'll be really cool to see how people use the data, because I think the idea is also to sort of put it through the paces, right? Because when you do a still, you've done obviously a lot of stills, right? But you can almost build the shader or the textures for that still. Like if you move the camera, you can't put it in any kind of lighting necessarily,
no.
Right?
No, I've tried. I mean, I've tried to get using the V-Ray shader. Tried to work with it and manipulate it to work with different lighting conditions, but it's not. It's not the stuff I do from like an artist standpoint. It's not 100% scientific.
Right.
Like there's always going to be flaws with what I'm doing because I'm basically using it to work with that lighting solution.
Right.
But imagine if you have data, have the maps, you have everything working correctly with no matter what lighting condition you use. Like everything is completely physically accurate. Like it's 100%. That for me is really exciting.
Right. Because then you can say, I was like, all right, well, so. Tell me the process that you actually go through. So let's say you're going to start. Let's start with the power guy or the portrait guy. How do you start your process?
So I find something. I want to work on something that I'm not going to be bored of, like working on my own face. I have got a little bored with that.
Right.
I try to work on something that I know is going to keep me going for a little while. I do try to make stuff as photoreal as possible.
Sure.
So I start with a head base mesh that I always have. I use the same base mesh for everything because I don't really have a need to make new meshes.
And it's let's just put it clearly, a base mesh, the most important part about a base mesh is the topology, right?
Yes.
So if you have the right topology, that's the foundation, and then you can shape that into any face, right?
Yeah. So I've actually done that, like even with the face I was working on myself, mm-hmm. I had this pretty clean topology from the head I've been using for a while. So I was able to quickly, I already have like a set of fax base, blend shapes basically for all the heads and
sure.
the box and stuff anyway. So it's easy enough for me to start manipulating and making shapes and stuff. So that for me is key to start off, having clean topology, clean edge flow, and a head I know I'm going to be able to sculpt on. And then from there, with my face, which was interesting, I did that I hadn't actually done before, is I actually used the 123D app from my iPhone from Autodesk.
The Autodesk
and
one?
I asked my wife to, it was like, hey, can you quickly take a quick scan of my head or whatever? And it gave me really rough data, but I was able to use that data as like a general guideline for proportions of what my
head was gonna be. Yeah, absolutely.
And it was, so right off the bat, it took me like a couple of days and I basically had a head that was in general proportion of what I was going to do. And then from there,
sculpted on top of that.
Yeah. So I sculpted on top of it and I, whether it's work or,
how do you get the data from 123 into Maya?
So it gives you a basic, it gives you, 123D app actually gives you, a OBJ with actual textures on it. Like a set of actual textures. The textures are more for reference for guidelines of where things are. But so it gives you a rough OBJ of that mesh. So I actually take that mesh, and I have my own head topology that I use, and I basically warp it over top.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't really care about the details it's going to give me, any of the data. I'm just more concerned with the general proportion. So I basically just use that as a reference point. Use my own head, my own topology to wrap on top of it, and then I end up taking that and bring it into Mudbox, and I sculpt all the details by hand just because I enjoy doing it. So whether I use, use like stencils or brushes within Mudbox, I try to do something different all the time. I'll do that. And I basically do all my texturing within, Mudbox too. For my head, I used some photo reference images. Mm-hmm. But most of the time I try to paint my textures by hand just because like if I'm taking I did everything with the iPhone for the head of myself that I was working on. So, I couldn't really use a lot of the images. So I just tried to do it all by hand and basically mm-hmm. take that head, set up. I already have like kind of a base shader that I've been using with V-Ray 3 for a while, small adjustments here and there and stuff, but I have like a formula that I basically use. And then, yeah, I bring that in, have this set of eyes that I've been using for, I don't know how long, a while. And I just play around with lighting conditions and try to get the skin the way I want it. And then basically, build the hair on top of that.
Right.
Shaving a haircut, bringing it into V-Ray. I don't really have a set formula.
Well, you do. You do have a few formulas because you use the same eyes, you use the same base mesh, and you use the same shader.
Yeah.
So that is your formula, and that's what, you know, it sort of brings continuity. You're not reinventing the shader every time.
No, no, I'm not, because there's I don't really have there's no.
But well, do you think you'll start using the WikiHuman shader at some
100%.
Point? Yeah.
So next project, I'm gonna start using that because I'm excited to see like how far off I am with my.
Well, it's gonna look, you know, it'd be interesting. It's like, you know, use your traditional method and then see if you can do one with the other shader and say, huh, here's one of my projects, you know, and here's how I did it before and here's how it looks now with this and here's the differences.
The Pirate Head actually might be a good starting point for that. Using that shader on the Pirate Head to see like how far off I was. But yeah.
It's interesting, Vic, as an example, people were talking about the 16K displacement map that we're using, the really high res stuff. Yep. And it brings up all this detail, et cetera, et cetera. You're like, well, you'll never be able to get that. And it's true. You won't be able to get that exact data without doing a scan or something, the method that they do it at ICT. But there are ways of looking at that data. And I think some of the guys who did it for a real-time engine actually did it all procedurally, right?
Yes.
So they know, based on what that data is, they say, based on this, I could probably make a procedural texture that matches that and it can get the breakup that you would want. So it'd be interesting for you to see like, oh, all right, you know, I can use this as an idea for me to make something that looks close for that micro scale geometry displacement.
Yeah, we do. There are tricks and stuff that we do in games games. We always try to find, I don't want to say a hack, but we try to find the easiest way to do it in runtime that kind of manipulates what's happening in real life.
Well, it has to be. I mean, it's real time. You can't. If you want someone to play a game at 60 frames a second, it's gonna have to be a hack of some kind.
Eventually, I think we'll be really close. But for now, we can't do that. So we do. There are procedural things that we try to do.
Yeah, and I think that's perfectly valid because I think that, you know, That's the thing, is that not I'm saying, well, this is the only data you should use. No, this is the basis that you could build upon, or if you feel there's actually, I think if someone has a better idea, let us know about it. You know, we talked about that idea as well as the idea of sharing this information and sharing our ideas. And you've seemed like you've always been very open about whatever you're doing to share that data, share that knowledge, right?
Yeah, I think it's awesome. For one, you get to share with other people, you get to see what people are going to do with it, and it's like, you know, there's nothing really to hide, right? Because everybody's working on different stuff anyways. No one's going to really benefit from taking a scanner of my head and like, you know, using that or whatever.
Yeah, what, you know. There's no benefit. It's like, oh, look, I took the model of Dan's head.
Why would you want to use my face to begin with?
exactly.
Creepy. Yeah. But I love the idea. And I've always tried to do as many tutorials as I can when I do have time and stuff, because I think there's a benefit of it. And it's not and the way I do things is it's just the way I do things. Like it's probably not the best way to do it. It's not necessarily the right way to do it. But it opens up discussion too. And I've done tutorials before where people ask like, well, why'd you do this? Like, why didn't you do this? And it's like, well, I actually never even thought about that. That's a good point.
Right.
You know? So it opens, I love the idea of opening up discussion. I love the idea of sharing and seeing, you know, where we're going to go. Because for me personally, even as a kid, like I want to break the uncanny valley. Like I think that one day we're going to do it. You know?
Well, I think we do it unknowingly here and there. And I think it's an interesting idea, right? So there's a few things that fascinate me about the Uncanny Valley. One is our fear of it.
Yeah.
why does it create such a visceral response? So I'm actually like, I want to know why people feel the way they do about the Uncanny Valley. And to you and I, we've been doing some human stuff. So when something's the Uncanny Valley, like, well, it's still in the valley, you know, it's fine. So we'll just work with it. But it's people will sometimes avoid working on digital human projects out of fear of the Uncanny Valley. No one's ever like, I don't want to work on this tank project. I don't know if it's going to look real enough. It's like, no one ever cares about that, you know. But if it's a person, they get really scared of it, right? Yeah. The Uncanny Valley to me is a fascinating thing. And testing, I'm more interested in why it's a failure than how to get out of the failure. Yeah. So I think that's the thing that I think scientifically on studying that is an interesting thing. And there's motivation, right? Mm-hmm. You're motivated by getting out of it. Yeah. And so is Paul, like at ICT. They're like, we want to get as much detail as possible because that's going to be the way that we feel is going to come out of the valley, where if it's as normal, scientific as possible, there's A equals A, then it's got to be that way.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really interesting idea, but I just like, you know, what testing, how detailed do we really need to get? You know, test that out. Does this look more real or less real? Or testing different types of, you know, how detailed do I have to get in the eyes, right?
Yeah.
And how detailed do I have to get into the in the mouth? Or do I have to do subtleties of blood flow? And does that really make a difference? And all of those things, I think, are things that are worth studying. And the Uncanny Valley is an important thing. I think I remember you on the Alan McKay podcast. You were talking about trying to take your rendering and seeing if you could actually make it pass as a photograph.
Yeah. For my passport.
For your passport. Yeah, that's not a good idea. Then.
No comment.
But yeah,
I know.
But someone actually did that. They did a painting, a photoreal painting.
Yeah.
And they did a picture of the painting of themselves and passed it for a visa application of some kind. And I think that they got in trouble for it. Someone found out about it. And it's like,
yeah, it's probably a federal offense, actually. you probably go to jail for it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
you know, as an idea, that's a really good idea to test the Uncanny Valley, right?
Wouldn't that be cool?
Yeah.
I thought it would be kind of interesting and stuff. I never ended up doing it because I ran out of time because I had to go to China and I was running out of.
I'm glad you didn't do it because we wouldn't be doing this podcast.
No, I don't think so. But I, speaking of what you said, like I love the idea of getting over the Uncanny Valley. Like I want to see it happen, and I think you're right. Like there are bits and pieces, and there are times, you know, Benjamin Button might be an example where you can't tell the difference.
Right.
But in general, if you were to take like a full CG character and render it to dialogue,
right,
it's still not there. And I don't I love looking at stuff, and I think you're totally right that people feel afraid of trying to hit a photoreal character in dialogue, trying to make it, you know, pass as a real person. And the tough thing is we don't have all the answers to how to do everything yet. We're getting there. Mm-hmm. Like we're all these bits and pieces and stuff that we're doing that the WikiHuman project's doing, what Paul and the ICT team is doing, it's all building up to figure out, you know, how to do it. But it's also nice seeing people take the chance and not fail, but not quite hit it.
Sure.
Because there's portions of it and parts that come up where you look at it and some things just look awesome and stunning. And it's like taking bits and pieces of that, like, oh, how'd they do that? Oh, this is the science behind this. This is the science behind that.
Right.
And using that and gathering all that information and keep pushing it forward. And I think, you know, even the conversation we've had with the WikiHuman with other, you know, either other companies and other people, that everyone wants kind of the same thing.
Right. Yeah, I think there's motivation behind it. And I think that, you know, you find subjects that you want to render because there's something that, like you said, you're not going to get bored of or you're going to be motivated by, right?
Yep.
So there's something that's very that you have a passion to do to make a representation of something that you care about, like your grandmother or your wife or whatever you're going to be doing. And I think that there's a reason that there's an emotional bond or connection that you make with a synthetic version.
That's a good point.
That connection. Yeah. And one is, it's gutsy too, because you are, you know, this is someone you care about, right?
Oh, it's ballsy. Yeah.
Yeah. It's someone you care about. Like, you know, I was talking about it at one point when there's been a discussion, and we're not going to get into too much detail because I don't want to tell too much away, but there was a discussion about needing this, possibly do a scan of another person that we're doing for the WikiHuman project. Mm-hmm. And I was talking about it with my wife and I said, you know, screw it. I'm just going to have the scan of me because I know I'm around whenever I need to get a scan done. Sure. Right. And then she says, you can't do that. And I was like, why not? She goes, you won't be able to look at yourself subjectively. So I don't know how you're doing the portrait, because I think maybe that's one of the struggles you're doing, is you're looking at yourself and like, I don't know if I can look at myself. Now, if it was a scan of my wife, I think it would be easier than being a scan of me.
I think the reason I took on the idea of working on myself is it's for me, it's more challenging actually working on my, there's bits and pieces. Like if I was working on my wife and I did it, if I worked on her and I did a terrible job, sure, and she wasn't happy with it, that's a fail. Like right off the bat. With me working on my face, I have the reference there all the time. I have a mirror. I can actually, I'll look back and forth and stuff. Might shave up a couple pounds, but like I always have the data there. So for me, it's the easiest way.
That was my reason behind it with the stuff. But I was like, but I think it's hard because one is,
it is,
you don't see yourself. You always see yourself in mirror form, right? So that's another issue.
It's so true. So when that's a really interesting point that you bring up. When I As I was starting to work on my head, actually, I ended up having two mirrors beside me to reflect off of each other to see how people would actually see my face. Because when you're looking in the mirror, you're actually seeing stuff flipped,
right?
Basically, right?
Yep.
And people don't really think about that. But when you work on heads, your face is so asymmetrical. Mm-hmm. When you're looking in the mirror, that's actually not what people are seeing.
Yeah. Well, when you see a photograph of yourself, sometimes you seem, it's not what you normally see every day.
I'm revolted all the time. That's tough, but so there are little things like that. Like I have like two mirrors going, you know, where I can actually see what people are, how people actually see my face or whatever. I just use it for reference. And because I'm not using like a really good scan, I'm still pushing and pulling points and stuff.
Right.
And it's not, again, it's not going to be perfect or anything like that, but it's been an interesting process.
Yeah. It's interesting. I don't know if you do this trick, but I know a lot of people who do modeling, especially character work and human work. Sometimes they'll actually they do even an animation. When something's wrong and I can't quite figure it out, like they're looking at their model or looking at their animation and just, you know, flipping back and it just something doesn't look right about it, and they can't, like, maybe it's this, maybe it's that. They sometimes take a mirror and put the mirror next to the monitor and look at the rendering or whatever's on the screen through the mirror, and because everything is reversed, suddenly the mistakes pop out.
100%. So that's actually really interesting, because all the heads I actually work on, I think my wife might have been, I tried to make my wife's face more symmetrical based off her feedback.
Don't make me look so uneven.
Doesn't look like that.
Yeah.
I actually take the images, like when I'm doing quick renders, I actually flip them horizontally in Photoshop. And I notice when I actually work on heads, I have one side of the face that's always drooping.
Mm-hmm.
And it's wrong, actually. Like, it's not correct. And I actually don't know why I do it, but when I model heads, I have one side of the face that's actually drooping.
Huh.
So I got to figure out, like, why I do that. But that's a really good point. You get an idea of how that actually looks. Like, once you start flipping images and stuff,
crazy. Because your droop is on the other side now.
Yeah, it's so true. And I've worked on even the pirate and a couple other heads I was working on lately, even at work. I flipped it and I was like, ooh, that looks wrong, and it shouldn't look like that.
Right.
So something's off there. But
yeah, another trick that's interesting to do, especially when you're doing stuff, is like sometimes people get really wrapped up in the details and like, oh, it looks really good. Just take whatever rendering or whatever you did and then scale it down to 100 pixels by 100 pixels. Thumbnail it, and you'll be shocked about, oh, there's actually a lot of detail in a macro scale, right?
Yes.
That you're missing. So the whole time the proportion's not been exactly right, you know, or something's been different about it.
Yeah.
So it's also really interesting, just like, what happens? Why is it that when you shrink something down, it just looks wrong?
That's a great point. Yeah. I even do that. I do that as kind of test, whether it's my, you know, Facebook art site or whatever, where I'm making, if I have like a render an image, I'll actually put it as my profile picture. And get kind of people's responses. Sometimes it's like, something doesn't look right. Something doesn't look, you know, off or whatever. That's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting because you'll see that if you do some rendering and I'll look at, you know, that's the thing about like a site, like a 3D Total or one of those, CG Society or whatever. The whole site is like a bunch of thumbnails, right? So then you zoom in and like, oh, okay. But like, that thumbnail should look.
It should look like the photo. It totally should. Yeah.
And so there's a reason behind that. It's always like scale down and see what's actually happening. And I noticed that, like with Emily as an example, that's not artists. That is scanned data. That's her. That is exact proportions down to the 10 micron level of what her face looks like. When it's scaled that rendering down, it looks the same as what it did when it was bigger. So, so there is a something that happens that you need to tighten up. So it's really interesting to see that.
I find with lighting too. Lighting plays. I find, and I do it every once in a while too to test my shaders. But people use really high contrast lighting.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to using more ambient light with your scene. And that gives off an impression of something doesn't look right either. Because how often do you see people with just a key light and then that's it?
Right.
Never.
There's always
right?
some fill.
Yeah. You're always going to have some fill.
even some ambient light around
100%.
It.
100%. Yeah. So that's the other thing too, is you see a lot of renders of these heads that sometimes I see. And the heads are actually beautifully done, but sometimes the lighting doesn't really help them out.
Right.
Because if you don't have any ambient light, you're never going to get the response of something looking as photoreal as possible.
Right. So. Yeah, it's true. It's kind of, they light it like a car commercial or something, right?
Yeah.
So they put a big old area light in there, which does, I mean, let's just, make sure everyone realizes big area light that's a lot of portraits are done that way.
Yeah.
But there is light all around them. They're not in a black room with a single light on them, very not often is that happening. If it is, it's usually, because they're trying to do a scary movie of some kind.
Yeah.
And so if you want your character to look like a scary character, that's
one light, you're done.
Yeah, exactly. Well, cool. Is there anything that you want to talk about or promote?
Not really. Just,
tell them what you're doing here.
So I'm here for E3, which has been, it's been actually awesome. So here for E3, Microsoft, we just, announced the fact that we're working on Gears of War 4.
Yes.
Which I'm working on right now, which is awesome. And the response has been really good and everything's been super exciting. And we also announced the ultimate edition of Gears of War, where we took the Gears 1 game and we totally redid it, reskinned it, re-everything or whatever, and we just released the beta for everyone else to play.
Is this basically similar to what they did with the Halo thing?
I don't know what they did with the Halo.
With Halo, I think they redid all the games at higher Xbox One quality.
Yeah, so that's basically – so the thing what we did with the Gears game is we literally rebuilt everything. So it's basically – it's the same great game, but it's completely rebuilt.
Yeah, to look
the
really
specs
high.
Of an Xbox One. And then people got a first glance of seeing what the new Gears 4 game is going to look like and stuff, and the feedback's been awesome. So
cool.
Just here and then doing the podcast here, did a podcast with Alan McKay on – I think it was Monday with us and the Gears of War team. And then just going to hang out and check out a couple of parties and stuff today.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. Yeah. Well, what was I going to ask you about? Do you have an Xbox One?
Yes.
You do?
Yep.
Because I've been thinking about getting one. And interestingly, I don't actually feel like I want to play video games on my Xbox One. I want to get it more for its media center stuff.
You can do the nice thing about Xbox One now is it's your media center, it's your gaming console, you can do everything with it. And actually, the big thing that I wasn't even aware of that they just released was the Xbox One now, it's backwards compatible with the 360 now. So
really,
yeah. Which so right now,
so you can play all your old games.
You can play all your old Xbox 360 games on an Xbox One, and I think they dropped. I'm not that I'm here promoting Xbox or anything like that, but
no,
for me that's
no.
That's,
I'm actually generally
awesome
asking.
Stuff.
I'm not trying to promote it either.
Yeah.
I'm just generally asking because I was like, I mentioned to Dan that I just moved into a new house and I convinced my wife to drop cable.
Yeah,
and so we basically only have internet. TV, so it's Netflix, Hulu, and stuff like that. And I get it through my TV. My TV has a smart TV, and it's got stuff. not necessarily the best place to watch that kind of stuff.
You can do all that with the Xbox.
And so I'm thinking about doing that, and it's like, and then I can just rent movies through there and do everything through there. Right?
Even the 360, I even use my 360 when I'm not playing games. Like I have Netflix on there, YouTube on there, HBO. Like I do all the stuff on there just because it's like one basic place or whatever.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like I need one thing, and I know that, you know, here's the other thing, right? It's an Xbox One. I know the graphics are going to be good. It's going to be fast enough to do whatever I want it to do, right?
Yeah.
So it's, I'm sure it's got a better processor than my Samsung TV does. So that would be interesting. Yeah. So I think I'm going to look into that. But yeah, I just wanted to ask you about that. But it was awesome seeing you. This is actually the first time we've actually met in person.
After all these years. Yeah, man, it's been great.
It's been really awesome. Cool. And I'm really looking forward to some of the new things you're going to be doing on the WikiHuman project.
Yeah,
which has been cool.
Yeah, I'd love to start getting more involved in that kind of stuff again. I'm really excited about it.
Well, right now we're still like, you know, pretty deep into the science right now. But I'm at the point where I want to sort of play with some of the other things, and we've got some really big announcements happening in that area soon. So, keep an eye out on wikihuman.org and follow us there. And I think that's probably we're going to let the last bucket drop.
I really wish I got to listen to the actual music. I actually love the tune.
Yeah. Just the tune. It's good.
I got playing in my head. Well, yeah, thanks, Chris. Yeah,
Gina, cut, you know, like whenever I, it's funny, whenever I come in the morning, Gina comes and goes, hello, welcome to, it was like, first thing in the morning, she's going to talk to me about it.
Like, that's awesome.
I was like, I know. And the last two podcasts ago, I had her do the intro with me. Yeah. And so she sat in here and, she says, all right, let's do the intro. And I said, hello and welcome to the CG Garage. And she just started cracking up. She couldn't keep a straight face. Just was like, yeah, I know. I do that thing every time. I was like, I don't know where I started
that.
But yeah, it's been a lot of fun. So yeah, you won't hear the music until the end. But we are going to let the last Becca drop either way. And I appreciate you coming by.
Thanks, Chris. And like props to you. Keep doing everything you're doing and stuff. It's awesome.
Oh, I really appreciate it. It means a lot coming for you, man. Thanks a lot.